This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books. Chapter 51. Mitchell slowed the engine down and looked at the pier. Once they'd come to terms for his surrender, his escorts gave him a wide berth. The fact that none of the men on either the Coast Guard or the Marine Patrol vessels had proper gear also made a difference. People Mitchell were negotiating with didn't want a replay of what happened that morning. The pier ran 1,000 feet out into the ocean. Mitchell could see that it had been cleared of fishermen and sightseers. The beach on either side had been evacuated in a mile radius. He looked to his left at the various Coast Guard and the other patrol vessels. They were moving into position to keep other boats away and form a blockade if Mitchell decided to run. He'd count at least 3 different television news helicopters in the sky, along with various law enforcement ones. Since that morning, having things be public wasn't as reassuring to him. It had no problem acting stupid with the world watching. From the news reports, it was clear that they were catching hell for what happened. 100 feet away from the floating dock at the bottom of the pier, Mitchell stopped the boat, then went into the cabin. He dug through some of the drawers and found a roll of high-test fishing line. He took the other flare gun from the floor of the cockpit and tied the fishing line around the trigger. He opened the gas cap and pointed the flare gun down into the tank. He then gently pushed the throttle forward and brought the boat up alongside the dock. Still holding the spool of fishing line, he tied the boat off. He knew it wasn't going to work because he'd already shot the flares from both guns at the sniper in the trees. Found extra flares, but decided to only reload the one he had on him. The fishing line was his own bit of theater. Maybe they could tell the trigger probably wouldn't work, but as long as there was the possibility it would, it gave Mitchell's threat some additional weight. Mitchell unspooled the fishing line and walked up the stairs that led to the pier above. As per his request, there was a table and a chair at the end of the pier within sight off the boat. On it were 2 cell phones, a walkie-talkie, a bottle of water, and a bag of takeout from Outback Steakhouse. Mitchell hadn't eaten all day and didn't want to enter into negotiations on an empty stomach. He walked over and sat down. A voice came over the radio. "Are you happy?" Mitch looked inside the takeout bag. "Forgot the steak sauce." "It's inside the container." Mitchell opened the styrofoam container. "Oh, thank you."
"Are you ready to talk now?"
Mitchell pulled the food out and unwrapped the knife and fork. "I need to make a phone call first." He looked down at the food. He'd heard stories of how the police drugged food that they sent to hostage takers. "If I feel the least bit woozy after eating this, I'm going to pull this cord. Is it safe to eat?"
"Yes, Mr. Roberts. No games on our part."
Mitchell picked up the phone and dialed. Rookman's familiar voice answered.
"Mad Mitch, I'm watching you eat right now on television. Couldn't you have gone a little bit more upscale?"
"Sticking to what I know," said Mitchell as he ate a mouthful of baked potato.
"You have a name for me?"
"Yep, I got the biggest cock puncher of them all for you. He's a guy to go to whenever somebody needs to stick a thumb in the government's eye."
Mitchell remembered the name from a few different high-profile cases.
"Thanks. So, what do you think my chances are?" "You know how in movies, it's your most trusted friend telling you it's safe to come in? I'm telling you it's safe to come in. So where are you?" "Fuck."
Mad Mitch dropped the piece of steak back into the container. Rookman telling him that things were safe was his way of telling him that things were absolutely not safe. In every thriller, if a friend tells you it's safe, then asks where you are, it means people are coming to get you. Mad Mitch stood up. He looked around. There was nobody anywhere near him. Of course, he knew that didn't mean there weren't Navy SEALs using gear like he had, waiting to disable his booby trap and shoot him. Mad Mitch picked up the radio. Is there anyone within 500 feet of me on land or water? There was silence. Everything is a safe distance away from you. That's not answering the question. Mad Mitch looked over the boat. How would they try to disable his threat? He looked at the water around the boat. There was less than a foot of visibility. If I see so much as one drop of fuel come out from the side or some hole that a diver has made at the bottom of the hull to empty the fuel tank, the deal is off. Mad Mitch thought for a moment. I'll tell you nothing.
Tell us nothing about what?
Mad Mitch took the cell phone and the radio off the table and walked back down the stairs to the floating dock. He put the cell phone in his suit and pulled the other flare gun and aimed it at the boat. He couldn't see any fuel leaking out of the water, but he didn't mean that they weren't about to try. Mad Mitch stepped inside the cockpit. He looked at the console and turned on the depth finder. The screen showed him a sonar image of the ocean floor below. I see two very large fish under my boat. Mad Mitch flipped a button that made a sound whenever something came within a few feet of the hull. It pinged. He held the radio to the speaker. I should not be hearing that sound. The voice on the radio spoke up.
It's a fishing pier. There're gonna be fish there.
Mad Mitch was looking at two very big fish on the screen. Then tell Aquaman that he needs to call his friends back. Mad Mitch looked over at a gaff stick under the side wall of the boat. He picked it up and held it aloft for the helicopters to see. Mitchell spoke into the radio. Are we being sincere with each other?
Yes, Mr. Roberts. We're being very sincere.
Then if I stick this gaffing stick under here and try to stab the fish under my boat, you wouldn't be bothered by that? There was a pause. The images on the screen drifted away. The sound of the depth finder dropped.
We may have had some people who were trying to secure the area who drifted away from their position.
Mitchell did a facepalm. He let out a sigh and then spoke into the radio. Listen, man, I know what happened today was a clusterfuck of epic proportions, and you guys are profoundly embarrassed by what happened, and I'm sure some genius up there is telling you that you can make up for it by doing some commando-style shit to get the upper hand on me. I got news for you. You can probably outsmart me and wear me down and have your guys take me down in some kind of face-saving way that makes it look like you guys are in control and not some third-rate DJ nobody listens to. It's no match for you. I won't erase the fact that you guys didn't listen to me earlier and people got hurt. It also doesn't mean that you suddenly have a grip on the situation. There's something seriously fucked up going on, and the sooner we can come to simple terms, the sooner we can march down to that pier, and we can all figure out what the bigger problem is. You get a lot of people watching us on television right now and listening to this discussion. You've told me twice that you're up to no tricks. There's no hostage here. You're not ethically obliged to lie to me to save them. I want to help. You send some Navy SEALs to shoot me or trank me while my back is turned, all you've done is shot the guy who knocked on your door to tell you your house is on fire. And I didn't start it. When the more crazy, clever bullshit you try to pull on me, the more people are going to be convinced that the reason you're trying so hard to not let me surrender the way I'm asking is because you're the ones who started the fire. Are you the ones who started the fire? No, Mr. Roberts, we're not. Do you have any idea who was in that helicopter and why they were trying to shoot me and decapitate me? No, Mr. Roberts, we do not. And please, keep your word to me. Let me finish my phone calls and take care of what I need to do on my end and make sure everything can go smoothly. Mitchell stepped out of the boat, walked up to the table and sat down. He pulled out the cell phone.
You got all that?
Yes, sir, replied Rookman. I'd get a hold of that lawyer soon.
I agree. Mitchell hung up with Rookman and got the number of a lawyer from a Google search on the phone. While he assumed the feds could have listened to the phone call, he was even more paranoid about them pretending to be the lawyer. A receptionist answered.
I'd like to speak to Trevor Smith, said Mitchell. Who should I tell him is speaking? She asked.
My name is Mitchell Roberts. Hello, Mr. Roberts. We've been waiting for your call. I'll put you right through.
Finally, some courtesy, thought Mitchell.
Mr. Roberts, I'm so glad you called.
The booming voice had a calming effect on Mitchell.
It looks like you've had a bad couple of days.
Not as bad as the people who got hurt, sir.
That's true. I just want you to know that I'm on your side. Everyone is on your side, especially after the way the Keystone cops handled it today.
He paused.
Yes, I'm talking to you, buffoons listening in. I'd remind you that I've got attorney-client privilege, if that would make a difference.
Either way, they can hear what I'm going to tell you anyway. I don't want you to step foot off that pier until they give you full immunity for everything that's happened.
That sounds great. Can you get them to agree to that? My office has already been talking to the Attorney General. We pointed out that if they wanted to charge you for acting in self-defense, then they would be obliged to charge half of their agents on the bridge for attempted murder, he said.
Yeah, but they couldn't help it. There's some kind of rage virus thing, said Mitchell.
That's exactly the point. Either they acknowledge that there's something real out there, out of your control, and agree to not charge you for trying to save your own skin, or say it's hogwash and have to try 24 FBI agents for attempted murder.
Smith went over a few more legal points with Mitchell, then got off the phone to speak with the head of the CDC, the governor's office, and the U.S. district attorney. He laid out his legal arguments and made the case that for everyone involved, it was the best to have Mitchell as a willing patient. He pointed out that he could get an injunction against them using any blood or tissue samples without his consent, and without those, they put their investigation into jeopardy. After they agreed in theory, he called Mitchell back to tell them that the immunity offer was only relating to the events of the past 3 days. He explained that they wanted to keep their legal options available in the event that Mitchell was found to be part of a larger plot.
Is 3 days going to be enough?
Asked Smith. Mitchell stopped to do the math.
My first encounter with the girl was 4 days ago. She just ran and screamed at me, and I ran away.
I'll include that, said Smith. Is there anything else?
Mitchell realized that Smith, ever the lawyer, was giving him the opportunity to ask for help if he was actually tied into some kind of terrorist plot.
No, that's fine. If they can give me this and make sure I'm going to be safe, I'll have my full cooperation.
Smith called back to say that paperwork was being drafted on the immunity.
The next issue is your care. I've asked that you be admitted to a private hospital of your choice, but they're insisting you be taken to the CDC. I don't think we can get in the budge on that.
Mitchell thought about it. Wait, what happens if they can't cure me? Then what happens?
I'm going to make sure that they have a trustee appointed to you to provide the best care possible. They won't be allowed to just lock you away in some dark room.
Mitchell hadn't contemplated the idea that he had something that might not go away. What if people tried to kill him for the rest of his life? The only safe place would be locked away, like a virulent disease. He didn't have any answers about who was trying to shoot him. Terrorists trying to cover their tracks. A renegade part of the government. After another hour, Smith called him.
You'll be allowed unrestricted use of communications. I've got 3 Nobel laureates who have agreed to act as trustees. Amnesty International and the Red Cross have offered to oversee your treatment.
Mitchell's appreciation for the well-connected lawyer grew every time he called. Behind him, the sun was beginning to lower into the horizon. He finished the last of the steak an hour ago. The final step was for a courier in a spacesuit to bring him the papers to sign. A voice came over his radio.
For us to allow the courier to come out, we need to disable your explosive device attached to the gas tank.
Mitchell still had Smith on the phone. He told him to proceed. Mitchell climbed down to the boat to pull the flare gun out of the gas tank. A sudden wave of paranoia overcame him. He pointed at the phone to call Rookman.
Rookman, I've been in the middle of negotiating, and I haven't listened to anything on the news in the last few hours. What have they said?
Mitchell was afraid that it was too good to be true.
The pardons and Smith's smooth tactics were all an act, and he was talking to an impersonator.
"They've been saying that Smith was making a deal for you," said Rookman.
"Should I go along with it?"
"Listen, kid, I don't think they're going to try anything more today, but I wouldn't pass them to try to find a new way to screw you later on. When, not if, they do, scream. Make a big noise."
"Thank you," said Mitchell. Mitchell unplugged the empty flare gun from the gas tank, and threw it onto the floor of the cockpit, climbed back up the stairs and sat down. The voice on the radio spoke.
"Please sign the documents as soon as you can, so we can get you to proper care."
A few minutes later, a man in a blue hazmat suit walked down the pier. He set down a sheaf of papers and pen on the table. Mitchell looked through the documents. There were two copies of the pardon. Two more, saying that the government was responsible for any liability claims made against Mitchell, and another document underneath them with an X next to where he was supposed to sign. He read the first few paragraphs, then picked up the cell phone. He gave the courier a look, and the man stepped out of range.
"Mr. Smith, why is there a document here about an agreement to limited liability?"
"That's to make sure the government is responsible for any liability claims against you," replied Smith.
"Yeah, but there's two here. One's different than the other."
"What? Read it to me,"
said Smith.
Smith listened, then blurted out, "Those assholes, they want you to give up their right to sue them."
"Sue them?"
"Of course. We're going to file papers on your behalf tomorrow," replied Smith.
"This isn't about money. It's about leverage, Mitchell."
"What do I do?" asked Mitchell.
"Tear it up."
Mad Mitch tore the document and signed the others. The courier looked down at the torn-up document and gave Mitchell a wink. He turned and walked back down the pier. 20 minutes later, the voice came on the radio.
"We're bringing a container down the pier for you to get into. It's airtight. It's got its own oxygen supply. From there, we're going to bring you to a temporary staging area to look at your wounds. Then we're going to transport you via plane to the CDC in Atlanta. Are you ready?"
Mitchell called Smith to get a reassurance that it was safe to proceed. Smith told him to cooperate, that he would meet him at the staging area, behind glass, of course. Mitchell told the voice on the radio that he was ready. At the far end of the pier, he saw four men in yellow hazmat suits push a large stretcher out onto the pier. When it got closer, Mitchell got a good look at it. It was a small plastic bed that looked like a sled with a plastic covering over the top. To Mitchell, looked like a glass coffin. The men lifted the clear top off the stretcher. One of them spoke.
"Mr. Mitchell, would you please have a seat here?
We can make sure you're securely fastened inside." Mitchell eyed the container warily. In his mind, he'd been hoping for something a little bigger, like an airtight limousine. Already mildly claustrophobic, the added paranoia wasn't helping any. The lead medical technician spoke to him.
"After we take you to the staging area, we can give you a sedative for the trip."
Mitchell just shrugged and got on the stretcher. Nobody protested when he put the phone in his pocket. Another technician fastened an air mask over his mouth. After he put his legs up, they covered him with a blanket. The lid came down, and he could hear the sound of its sealing. The lead medic gave Mitchell a thumbs up. Mitchell nodded weakly. He'd gone from a man on the run to letting them put him in a box, smaller than the coffin he felt bound for. The medics began pushing the clear coffin down the pier and towards a large van designed for transporting hazardous materials. Mitchell tried to calm himself by accepting the fact that everything was out of his hands now. No more running. No more seeing people get hurt. In the back of his mind were 100 different paranoid thoughts. He should have asked for Secret Service protection. He should have demanded a 24-hour live internet feed showing the world his treatment. Damn, he'd have been streaming the whole thing. Overhead, he could see the news helicopter still flying around. What happened when he was put inside the van, or locked away for treatment? Why didn't he just aim the boat for the ocean and keep going? He'd had to have felt safer than he did at that point. They finally reached the van. The medic slid the casket into the sealed-off back area, head first. The wheels were locked into grooves on the floor. The first medic, the one who gave him the thumbs up,
stepped inside. Another medic began to step into the back and was waved off by him. That was odd, thought Mitchell. You'd think they'd have this kind of thing sorted out. The doors were shut. Mitchell looked around the interior of the van, and then at the one man inside of him with it. He was trapped. Chapter 52. Restricted by the glass casing, Mitchell tried to turn his head to look at the man in the hazmat suit sitting just past his shoulders. It's hard enough to make out a face through the glass shield of the helmet without Mitchell's old scared face reflecting back at him from inside the plastic dome that trapped him. Mitchell could feel the van begin to move. He thought about shouting for help, but knew no one would hear his muffled voice through the respirator and the van's thick walls. The man in the hazmat suit slid across the metal breech so Mitchell could more clearly see him. The man looked out a small window at the rear of the van and then back towards him. He placed a gloved hand on Mitchell's casket.
Mitchell, said the man's voice from behind the ventilator in his mask. I guess the only way to explain things is just to come right out and tell you, the man paused. When they get you to the facility, they're going to find out that there's nothing wrong with you.
Nothing wrong with me? Was this guy crazy? Thought Mitchell. The man continued.
And then it's going to get even worse for you. People will begin to start asking questions. Questions that others don't want answered, and that's why they are going to kill you.
Mitchell's eyes bulged behind his own oxygen mask. Was this man an assassin? He ran his fingers along the edge of the container, trying to find some way to crack the seal and get out. The man looked down at Mitchell struggling. He reached into his pouch and pulled something out and set it on top of the plastic casket. Mitchell's eyes tried to focus on the object just inches above his head. It was a screwdriver.
You'll need something like this to get yourself out, but I don't suppose you have one of those on you.
No matter. The man leaned back and looked at a watch strapped to the outside of his suit.
We have very little time.
Mitchell looked down at his feet. He braced his hands against the side of the container and began to kick. Maybe it wouldn't set him free. At best, it would attract the driver's attention. The man in the suit put another hand on the casket and shook his head as he looked down at Mitchell.
Mitchell, I'm not here to hurt you. I'm here to help you.
Mitchell stopped kicking and looked at the man.
Who are you?
I'm part of this, Mitchell, but I never wanted to be part of this. He tapped the casket. I'm a doctor. I'm a group that spends its time worrying about the worst-case scenarios and trying to prevent them.
Like this? Asked Mitchell.
The man shook his head.
Much, much worse, Mitchell. This was a side effect, a mistake that happens when people act without thinking, when they do things out of fear.
We're at war, Mitchell. Mitchell tried to look into the man's eyes and read if he was being sincere or just trying to calm him down so he didn't alert the driver.
At war with who?
The future, Mitchell. It has many faces, many threats. We take tiny pieces of information, and from these tiny pieces, we extract a bigger picture. Sometimes that picture is more horrible than you can imagine. When that happens, you have to act. You're here because certain people decided to act in a certain way. I told them they were too motivated by fear, but it didn't matter. What they saw was too terrifying to act any other way.
Mitchell was silent as he tried to make sense of what the man was saying.
A few months ago, we found something. It was a virus, basically. A modified version of a pneumonia-causing virus. The kind of virus that everyone has in their body, but their immune system keeps in check. But this virus had something special in it, a set of instructions that would flip a switch in your body that had been dormant for 100 million years. Ever wonder how animals can tell family members apart? It's in the pheromones, chemical fingerprints. Everyone has them. They're what makes us want to fuck. They're what makes women jealous when they smell another female on their mate. They're what make men want to kill each other in bars filled with available women. The virus has been engineered to make people want to kill each other when they smelled another human pheromone. Any kind. It turned on the fight-or-flight response in our brains and turned us into reptiles trying to rip the throat out of any other animal that had the same chemical fingerprint. The virus is highly contagious,
and we know that it could spread quickly if it got loose. In a few weeks, every man and woman on this planet would be trying to murder each other with their hands and teeth. Who would make something like that? Asked Mitchell. The Russians, the Chinese, us, maybe the Indians. It could be an ally that made it and set it loose. The problem was that we knew it was out there. Somebody had it, and we had to do something about it. That's when some clever people came to us with an idea of how to inoculate us against it. We heard that Chinese party officials were getting vaccinated for some mysterious reason, and we had to act. Problem is that the virus works even in its weakened form. We needed to create something that acted like it to prevent it from infecting us in the first place. And if it did, override the chemical triggers it sent to the brain. That's when we had the idea. My idea. Change the pheromone trigger from a general one to a specific one. Instead of targeting any human, only one unique pheromone would set it off. The man gestured toward Mitchell. And that, my friend, is where you came in. It was a simple mistake, a mislabeled vial here, a truncated database. I don't know the specifics, but I can draw you the picture. You donated blood 3 years ago on your college campus, a sample, and it ended up in a lab looking for pheromone triggers in blood. Yours wasn't special, no offense. It was just a control sample. From your blood, we sequenced that part of your DNA that coded for one of your unique pheromones. Some we all share, others are one in a sextillion combination that will never occur in a billion years of human history. Instead of creating a random one to plug into our countervirus, we fucked up. We used yours. A few weeks ago, we got the go-ahead to covertly inoculate the population. We began spreading the virus in subways, restaurants, everywhere. Symptoms were so mild we were able to run under the cover of a convenient flu outbreak. I suspect the only person who got noticeably sick was you. Your body didn't know what to make of it. That's why you were sick at home. That might be why you've lasted this long. And so there's the problem. Other people get a look at you, they're going to realize that you're perfectly healthy. We're the ones who have been infected. We're covering our tracks so far by modifying gene libraries of pneumonia viruses and made sure that epidemiology reports are filtered through friendly hands. But it's a small group of people trying to maintain a large conspiracy. That can't last for very long if you're alive. That's why they're going to come for you. They don't see themselves as murderers, so they won't come for you with guns and knives. They're doctors. They'll kill you via committee. A group of people will prescribe a treatment for a condition that doesn't exist, and just to be cautious, they'll treat you for other conditions as well, until you're dead. They'll cure you to death, so people who know better can keep the real secret hidden. Once you're dead, your body will be sealed up and buried away in some basement where they keep vials of smallpox and polio. A tentative explanation will be given, some kind of hormonal trigger you gave off. And that will become the accepted wisdom, because there will be no more Mitchell Roberts around to test and poke. The end. The man began to unlatch the buckles on the top of his casket. Of course. Then the people who did this will get overconfident, and the next time they might even get more sloppy, or even worse. Someone might decide we need to be proactive and create a virus that only gets the bad guys and go ahead and release it. It's not like a nuclear missile. We need 1,000 people to build, maintain, and launch these things. All it takes is one asshole with a test tube. Mitchell watched as the man finished unlatching the casket. He picked up the screwdriver and lifted the container open like a clamshell. Mitchell eyed the screwdriver. The man turned it over and handed it to Mitchell, handle first. "Too bad they didn't search you for this when you got inside," said the man. He reached to the floor and pulled out a small bag, produced a syringe. Mitchell recoiled. "Don't worry. It's for me, not you. We need to switch places. You in my suit, me in the casket. But in order to do that, I'm going to have to be unconscious, unless you want to fight me off, and I'd rather we didn't do it that way."
What do I do then? Mitchell asked.
When we come to a stop, they'll unload me, thinking I'm you. That's when you need to get out and make it to my car. Keys are in a bag. From there, you need to get away as fast as possible. In my car, you'll find a laptop. There's a file called Great Wall. That's what you need.
Mitchell tried to put all of it together.
Is that a cure?
The man laughed.
No. The only cure right now is transparency. You'll need to share that file. It's got everything you need about what happened. The problem is that you can't just email it to people or upload it to Google. Ever since WikiLeaks, we've taken some extreme measures to filter and protect sensitive information. Filters on email servers, worms in storage servers that cause disk failures when certain phrases show up. There's even rooms full of people that do nothing but create credible-looking forgeries of government documents to confuse and waste the time of people trying to find the truth.
So what do I do? Asked Mitchell.
Keep doing what you've been doing. Run. Stay alive. And when you find a way, tell people everything. Broadcast it. The only safe place for you is in plain sight.
The man opened the wrist of his suit and injected himself.
Place my body inside, cover my head with the pillow, then move. You'll have maybe 2 hours before they realize that I drove my own car and my lab assistant is using the rental with the tracking. Then, find some other way to keep going.
The man's eyes began to get droopy. Mitchell tried to think of anything else to ask him. A million questions came to mind.
What's your password? Asked Mitchell.
Password. I almost forgot.
The man's body began to go slack. Mitchell had to grab his shoulders and keep him from falling over.
The password is Love Strange.
Chapter 53. The van came to a stop. Mitchell was convinced the moment they opened the doors, they'd see that he made the switch and the gig would be up. He did his best to look down at the plastic casket, at the face of Dr. Lovestrange, or whatever his name was, covered with the pillow and a towel, and act as casual as could be. Four more men in spacesuits were at the back of the van waiting for him to unload. Mitchell helped them move it while avoiding eye contact. He kept his eyes down on his patient while trying to scope out where he was. Four sets of work lights illuminated the area where they had unloaded the van. Directly ahead was a large plastic door, the kind of thing you saw in movies before you saw the bodies of a crashed alien behind it. In and around the work lights were several other people in spacesuits watching the proceedings. The whole area looked like some kind of improvised processing facility. What looked like 100 police cars with their lights still flashing surrounded the area beyond the lights in a perimeter. The police were staying inside of their cars to avoid contamination, or whatever they were calling it. At first he panicked at the thought of moving through them. Then he realized the attention was on the casket. Mitchell allowed the men to push through and move away from him as they headed toward the big plastic door. Once they got close to it, Mitchell stepped to the side and walked between two of the huge work lights and into the shadows, where other people in spacesuits were watching from behind a barrier. Acting like he had business elsewhere, he walked right past the line of police vehicles, and nobody looked twice. Past them, he could see a parking lot filled with cars, various government vehicles, and trucks. That's when he realized that the processing facility was actually the Park Square Mall. Mitchell knew criminals often returned to the scene of the crime. For him, it wasn't a choice. He moved out into the parking lot and toward the cluster of cars. Nobody stopped him, so he kept moving. Off to one side, there was a small encampment of trailers with people in and out of suits walking around. Somewhere, he was sure there was a decontamination booth and lockers for the suits. Since nobody stopped him, he kept walking toward the cars. There was no time to waste acting guilty. Mitchell fumbled the key from a pouch and clicked the unlock button. The dark blue Ford Explorer's lights blinked a dozen cars away. He wasn't sure how suspicious he'd look getting into the car with the suit on, but he was even more afraid of what would happen if he had approached it with it off. Mitchell also didn't know if it were possible to drive with a bulky oxygen canister strapped to his back. Mitchell waited until the last second as he got to the car and quickly stripped the suit off, tossed it into the passenger side on top of the laptop bag.
He'd put it in back of the duffel bag later. For the time being, he just needed to get out of there. Mitchell started the SUV up and headed toward the exit. All the entrances to the mall had police cars, making sure that no unauthorized vehicles entered. He'd hoped that they'd assumed everybody inside had business in there and could leave without having to show identification. Even so, Mitchell's face was the most recognizable one in South Florida. He looked around the interior, found a pair of reading glasses in the center console. Mitchell put them on as he headed toward the exit, where a cop with a flashlight was standing. Act casual, thought Mitchell. He reached down and picked up a cell phone Love Strange had left behind. He put it to his ear and had a pretend conversation when the cop looked over at him. Mitchell nodded. The cop pointed toward the main highway and waved Mitchell on. Mitchell pulled out of the mall for the second time in 3 days in a car that wasn't his own and no idea where to go next. Baylor couldn't make up his mind if he wanted to follow the motorcade surrounding the ambulance or get a careful distance away. He'd gotten Steinmetz on the processing team, but all he could hope for was information. He wasn't a team player. Steinmetz had trouble with the difficult choices. Baylor couldn't count on him to do the really hard stuff. For that, he needed Mr. Lewis. By the time, he should be finishing up cleaning the mess he and Mr. Travis had made. A little arson and an incriminating letter about trying to stop the Islamic traitor Roberts, and they had a credible Jack Ruby in Travis. Helicopter pilots were always kind of nutty to begin with. Baylor could make sure that the record of post-traumatic stress was available on the man, and he'd just be an odd footnote in the Mitchell Roberts story. The next step was making sure that the story ended the next day. The longer the CDC and others had a live specimen, even worse, a lawyered-up specimen, the more problems for Great Wall. Baylor decided his next step would have to take place somewhere after Mitchell left the South Florida area. The CDC was pushing to have him brought to Atlanta. That would have been too problematic for Baylor. If he could get the Pentagon involved, he could have Mitchell sent to an army base where they dealt with bioterrorism. There, he could count on less civilians and more people tied into his own network. He pulled out a phone and called his contact in the West Wing. He would follow the motorcade back to the mall at a more leisurely pace while he strategized on how to get who he needed on the committee that would actually be overseeing Mitchell's care.
This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.